Here we are.
Yes, if you're just joining, welcome to the Journally Spooky Podcast. Well, we're back with episode 3.
We are.
Welcome.
Welcome. Nice to have you here.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you're enjoying season 3 so far.
Did you enjoy Mary, Queen of Scots?
I know I did.
If you didn't listen to it, go listen.
What are you doing here?
It was a masterpiece. It's like 2 hours long.
It's 2.5 hours long. It's
2.5 hours? What?
Heavy.
It was a lot.
Hefty.
I had nearly 40 pages of script.
That was a lot of script.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just that episode was a lot.
Yeah. So yeah, if you haven't listened to it, it's our masterpiece, so you have to.
Yeah.
Then come back and listen to this episode.
God, you're so bossy.
No, I'm just opinionated.
So you're not here to listen to my opinion. Why are you?
Well, seriously, I hope you did enjoy the Mary, Queen of Scots episode, if you did listen. It was a labour of love, and we thoroughly enjoyed recording it.
We did.
It was really good fun.
Super interesting. Provided so much context for so many of the episodes, especially the witchcraft series. I think it's a nice addition to the witchcraft series.
It kind of just brought it all together,
mm-hmm.
since this happened before the witchcraft stories.
Yeah.
So it just gives you the historical context, mm-hmm. that helps you understand them a bit better. I think, anyway.
Adds it to the GSP universe.
The GSP Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah. Though our cinematic universe is just the actual universe.
Yeah, it's just historical events and people that really existed.
It happened, people. It may or may not have happened, how we're telling it.
I mean, I do my best.
Yeah.
I try to verify as much as I can.
You do what you can. What do we have today?
Well, yes, we are back to you not knowing what episode is going to be.
Yes.
Because we just recorded episode 1, but...
Yep.
So that doesn't make sense.
Got it!
Yeah, we are talking about the House of Dunn today.
Welcome to the House of Dunn.
Okay, you get that one and that's it.
That's all I wanted. That's I'm out. It. Again.
It's our first haunted house of the season.
Ooh.
And this was actually your request.
It was. I came across this somewhere. I think it was on a list of like spooky places to visit, I think.
Well, yeah, it's actually your request. Mm-hmm. I have gotten to it and now we're talking about it.
Here we are.
But you don't know the details or anything.
Nope.
No.
Let's face it, I just wanted to choose this one so I could sing that little bit song. That's the real reason.
Okay. Well, I did all of the research and all of the background, so now you're going to sit and listen to the story, even though you've sung that little bit of chorus.
Fine.
Well, like just about every other haunted house or castle that we've covered so far, the House of Dunn has a lot of history, but also has a lot of spooks. So I think I'm going to stick with what I've done in the past, where we'll cover the history and learn a bit about the house, and then we'll talk about the spooks.
Sounds good to me.
Sound like a plan?
Half history, half spook, half nonsense.
Exactly. Three halves of the whole. I'm pretty proud of what I've been able to do for this episode. I look through old parliamentary records and the court summons, and it was a lot. And I'm not a professional researcher, so it's not up to a professional research standard. It's just a big deal for me. I'm very proud.
I mean, that sounds intense.
It was.
It's more than I did today.
Very true. Anyway, the House of Dunn. It's actually quite near Brechin, which I'm now saying correctly, I believe. Brechin, which is quite near Glam's Castle.
Oh, that's where it came up.
Mm-hmm.
I remember.
Yeah, which was another spooky episode that we did in season 1.
Yes, it is.
If you haven't listened before.
That makes much more sense earlier on while you were researching. Going, I have to play something weird real quick. And the little animatronic voice went, Brechin.
I decided not to say it like that. But I think I pronounced it Brechin in the Glams episode.
Did you welcome the Brechening?
I'm trying to just talk about my experience and my life. And you keep just telling me puns, and it really upsets me. Well, I thought you would be interested. It's quite near Brechin. So it's in Montrose and sort of the Perthshire area. That's where we are today.
Excellent. Sounds good.
And it belonged to the Erskine family for a really long time. They were given the estate in 1375 and had it right up until 1980.
Oh, wow.
So almost 600 years.
And then someone lost it? That's a shame.
Well, we'll get into how that happened. It's not actually that bad a story.
Well, that's good. Only because when I found this, I wondered if it was anything to do with the Erskine Bridge.
I don't believe so.
No, the Erskine Bridge just goes from Erskine to somewhere else.
Yeah, the place Erskine.
Yeah, it's a place apparently.
If I were to give the Erskine family a one-sentence summary, it would be that they were a very powerful family.
I was waiting for incestuous. So
no,
that was
no, we're okay.
Not this time.
No, not this episode.
Everyone has enough grandparents this time?
Yes.
That's good.
Thankfully.
That's what we want.
I think. We'll just go with that. I don't want to think about it anymore. When I was looking through the Erskine family history, and basically their entire family tree for this episode, I was drowning in successful lawyers and ministers.
Oh.
So they've had a lot of influence for a long time.
Wow.
Very smart. And this is how they ended up with such a lovely estate and house to their name. So it makes sense.
That makes sense.
Nowadays, the House of Dunn is what's known as a Georgian country home, which is a very specific style of country mansion that wealthy people used to build for themselves as a way of showing off their prestige.
I saw the picture of it. It is very just like big and square. It's very block shaped.
It is.
There's not.
It is.
It's not long with turrets or anything. It's just a big Lego house. A big old house, though.
Well, I think the original design was more towery castle-like.
Oh, okay.
But they ended up going with this. It's just two stories, I think. Two or three stories, I can't remember. And it's just a big block. But a lot of Georgian houses were designed in that style. So a lot of the like Regency-style houses that you get that are in like Pride and Prejudice and things like that. They're all that style of home.
It's how I imagine the house in Jane Eyre, weirdly.
Yeah, yeah. It's very like that. So we're not talking massive big castle, but it is a huge mansion. And, you know, it has all of the gardens. There's a big walled garden at one point, and there's some forest around it. All kinds of stuff. So it is big.
That is big. Do you think you have to have, like, a requirement? Because could we just call this the House of McRae? You know?
I mean, your mum and dad might be upset.
As will many other McRae's, but yeah. No, why not?
Well, no, because
it's probably a lot of Duns, if that's why they're Duns. I don't know why it would be Dunn.
Well, arguably, Elan Donnan is the House of McRae.
No? Well, arguably, but maybe just get to call it.
Maybe we should look into it.
Hmm.
Start some, like, clan wars.
Well, because if it's the
get
House...
Get that going again.
The House of Dunn, because they could have called it anything.
But they were Erskine. I think Dunn is the area.
Oh.
Or, like, the title.
Yeah.
Of Dunn.
Just curious.
Well, yeah, maybe we should look into it.
Because it's a very big, specific type of house that's the house of something.
Yeah.
Fun and such.
Anyway, before the house was built in 1730, the house that's there now, there was a castle on the Dunn estate.
Oh.
A pretty big one by all accounts. But all that's left of that castle now is one big archway.
Oh.
That's kind of ruined. That's all that's left. And there was also a church and a graveyard on the land that some of the Erskines were like buried in. They have a family tomb there.
Spooky.
It is spooky, but it's also pretty ruined now from what I understand.
They're both done for.
Can you stop? That's the third pun in 11 minutes. I have had it up to here.
Everyone will listen like, oh, Kieran, just let her tell the... Fuck.
Do you ever do that when you're editing? Do you ever hear yourself, like, if you interrupt with a joke and you just feel yourself going, shh?
No, I'm just laughing. It's hilarious.
Fair.
I'm my perfect audience. I just, like, fast forward through when you're speaking while I'm editing. Let's get to the good bits.
That is hurtful. I put a lot of work into this. That is hurtful. Well, I forget where I started with this, but there's a funny connection that I want to make that I put some effort into, because you know how I just said that some of the Erskines are buried in their family tomb on the grounds of the estate. Well, some of the other Erskines are buried in Greyfriars Kirkyard.
Very cool.
So there you go.
Do they have headstones, I wonder?
I think so. I couldn't find any information on where they were buried. I think I would need to have a look at the like internment records and stuff. Yeah. But they were a very wealthy, influential family, so I feel they would definitely have a headstone of some kind.
Yeah, at least a headstone, if not a little like mausoleum bit.
Yeah, I don't know where in the kirkyard they are, but apparently some of them are buried in the kirkyard, which we talked about in episode 1, if you haven't listened.
Yes, we did. And that we talked about yesterday.
Yeah, we only recorded that episode yesterday. Archaeologists have been pretty interested in the ground of the Dunn Estate because there's proof of the ancient civilization and people living on the land. 9,000-year-old evidence of people living on the land. They've excavated like Bronze Age barrows, so where people were buried. They've found a couple of them in the surrounding area, which is just amazing.
That is amazing.
And if you're an Outlander fan, there's a standing stone really close to the house in the Dunn Estate, and it's called the Stone of Morphy. I can't remember how tall it is. It's insanely tall, really big, big standing stone. And there's lots of ancient standing stones across Scotland. We can only really guess at their purpose. No one can definitively say what they were actually for. In some places, it looks as if they could have been used as part of important rituals. In others, there's some evidence that they were used as calendars because they track the movement of the sun, either through the month or through the year, or markers of some kind. For some people, standing stones are just the perfect method of transport for finding yourself in the arms of a hunky, romantic 18th century Highlander. I'll leave you to your business. You can feel your feelings. But like I said, the Erskines were given the land way back in 1375.
It's crazy, that's because this is, again, you've talked about it before, how it's always weird when land has been lived on for such a long time.
600 years.
Yeah, well, 9,000 years.
Oh, well, that's true. Yeah, I wasn't even thinking that. I was just thinking how long the Erskines had the estate and the house for.
And that's 9,000 years that they discovered. Like, who knows how long before that?
Yeah.
It's weird that I was listening to Neil deGrasse Tyson talk about physics, and he was talking about in, 100,000 years? Probably more than that. A long time away. We'll only be able to see inside our own galaxy because we'll be too far away from all the other galaxies, so there'll be just much less stars in the sky. Which is quite weird because the universe is expanding. Eventually they'll be too far apart, so it must be more than 100,000 years. Anyway, so at that point, like, a lot of physics, unless it's been carried on, will be lost because you don't know what you're not looking at, so to speak, because all you can observe is our galaxy. Then that's all you'll know that's there. Whereas we can observe other galaxies as well. That's quite weird.
That messes with my brain.
Well, I was thinking it's then weird to think about it just historically. Like, there's all these cultures and religions and stuff that are just gone. And we have no idea. And there's no way to know, because it's just gone.
Well, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. Strange.
Woo. Before the Erskines had the land, a man called John Hastings and his family had it before. Now, he was the baron of something and the lord of something else. It doesn't really matter to our story, so I didn't look too much into it. But apparently King William the Lion gave him the land at the end of the 1100s. So that's kind of where families that we recognise started having it.
So when it became, like, royal land, so kinda, to speak, lordly land.
Rather than just sort of mysterious people living on it, we know who owned it. Now, I did find one document that explained that the land was actually bought in 1348.
Okay.
By a Sir Robert Erskine of Erskine. Which could be how the Erskine family got hold of it.
That makes sense.
But I've seen a couple of things that they got it in 1375. This says it's earlier. This happens a lot. I see a couple and I don't have any authority to decide one or the other. So there's both.
There's both.
But it's just, it's a matter of 30 years. So
In the scheme of things, that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said at the top, there were lots of notable Erskines who lived at Dun, because they were a very influential family. And I've picked a couple of the juicy ones to talk to you about.
Excellent, excellent.
You'll be pleased to hear.
You didn't tell me you were drowning in Lord Erskines.
Oh, so many Lord Erskines, Laird of Dun. They all have the same name.
Yeah. I am Lord Erskine, son of Lord Erskine, son of Lord Erskine, son of, well, you know.
Well, eventually I'm looking at the 13th Laird of Dun, another Erskine. I'm like, I can't tell them all apart.
It's Glam's Castle all over again.
Oh, it drives me mad. So this took longer than it probably should have to put together, because I just, well, I had to make sure I was talking about the right person.
Hmm. There's no rhyme like with Henry VIII's wives.
No, that's a lot easier. And there's only six of them, so, you know, not 13 and over. First, we have John Erskine of Dun. Now, from what I can find, he had a pretty terrible reputation around Montrose, the town nearby.
Mm-hmm.
He was not well liked. And he had a lot of power, which can make for some pretty horrendous outcomes.
Yep, that's always a good combo, isn't
it? We've seen this before. This doesn't end well. Now, I spent ages looking, and I couldn't find the actual court documents, which annoyed me. But apparently, he actually received a court summons, he and his sons, because the town wanted him brought to court and punished for how awfully he was treating them.
Oh, dang.
Mm-hmm. They called him a tyrant. And they wanted him punished by the king.
Jeez, oh, I suppose, because he would have had a lot of power over local land and things, wouldn't
he? Well, yeah, and I think he probably owned a lot of it.
Yeah.
I feel that would have been a problem. But he was that bad that they brought him to court. And this was in 1493.
Wow. Brought to court just for being an asshole.
Yeah. But I couldn't find the actual, like, documents or the sort of versions of those records that people have typed up. Which really annoys me, because that always makes me question whether or not it's actually true.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, apparently he was brought to court with his four sons.
Outrageous.
Now, two of his sons were killed in the Battle of Flodden, which we haven't really discussed before, other than talking about the Flodden Wall, which was built in Edinburgh. So I'll just give you a brief summary for the sake of just understanding that two of the Erskine sons were killed. I saw in one place that one of his sons was the private secretary to King James IV.
Okay.
But I couldn't find any other records. I need like a professional researcher to come and help me, because I just don't have the knowledge to find these things.
Yeah.
And I don't have like all the access to, like, JSTOR and all the fancy libraries and stuff. I don't have that. I can't afford it.
Is this James IV who led to James VI?
No, so James IV, he's king just now during the Battle of Flodden.
Mm-hmm.
He's killed at the Battle of Flodden.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's King James V.
Yes.
Who, when he found out that he'd had a daughter called Mary, who was his only heir,
yes, yep,
he died.
Oh, because I know there's then King James VI and first.
Yes.
So I was like, oh, was it fourth after first or fourth before sixth?
No, it was fourth, fifth, sixth in Scotland.
Yeah.
And in England, it went, what did it go?
First.
Well, yeah, but like Elizabeth I was before James.
Mm, yeah, Henry, Elizabeth, James.
Yes, that's it. So that's where we are. So King James IV, he was killed at the battle. And the Erskines were actually allies of the royal House of Stuart for a long time,
mm-hmm,
which is part of the reason that their men died at Flodden. They were supporting the king. And the battle happened on the 9th of September, 1513. So about 500 years ago, and it was a huge battle between Scottish and English forces, and unfortunately, as is often the case, the English were victorious, but the slaughter that happened that day was brutal. Mm-hmm. A lot of men got just taken down because they were fleeing, and they got caught in like a bog, and they couldn't go anywhere. It sounded awful. It was in Northumberland, in the north of England, and yet, I said King James IV died in the battle, which made him the last British king to die in battle.
Oh, wow.
He was the last. So the Erskines played an important part in Scottish history. They were around for a lot of it and had a lot of influence, rubbing shoulders with a lot of important people.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of on the sidelines, but they were there. Next, we have John Erskine. The second of many Johns.
I was about to say, are they just all called John? Seems likely.
Well, see, there's lots of Johns and there's lots of Roberts. That's the name that kept cropping up over and over again. So I'll do my best to differentiate between them for you.
That sounds good.
John Erskine was born in 1509. And in another weird thing to think about happening in the 1500s, he went to university in Aberdeen.
That is a weird thought.
I doubt he got to enjoy freshers the way that all the new students will be doing it at the moment, but he was an educated man. He went to university about 20 years after a Scottish king had been killed on a battlefield.
Weird.
Isn't it weird when you have things like that that happen very close together?
Well, I'm pretty sure Oxford University was there when the Aztecs were building their pyramids and things.
Yeah, you see quite a lot of those online, don't you, the comparisons?
Because Oxford University was founded in like 1100, so this is 400 years later.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even new. Well, that might be new, but...
So yeah, 20 years after a king was killed on the battlefield in a blaze of glory, he was going off to uni.
Packing his bag, getting a student cookbook together.
Yeah.
Packing all his servants.
I feel that doesn't happen anymore.
Mm.
I mean, it's been a while since we were at uni, but I feel like that doesn't happen
anymore. Well, I was being him going to uni. In
1530. 09. He was born in 09, so around 1520, 1530. Mm-hmm. Now, he was very smart, but as a young man, he seems to have been one of those people who is incredibly academically clever.
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't really have a lot of street smarts or common sense. Because when he was 21, he had to flee the country.
That's a fast turnaround.
Yeah.
What did he do?
He killed a priest.
I mean,
I'm being a bit dramatic. But from what I could see, he caused the death of a priest.
Oh, I see. Did he throw a stool at him?
No, don't think so.
I've heard that kind of happened.
There was no word about it being deliberate, but I couldn't actually figure out what it was that he had done that caused the death of a priest. But it's still a terrible thing to do.
Still pretty terrible.
So he had to get the hell out of Dodge. He had to leave.
Well, do you think he was giving his confession and he confessed something so heinous the guy had a heart attack?
I mean, that opens a lot of questions. What could he have done? Oh yeah, he had to leave. But it was while John was abroad that he would discover his life's passion, his purpose. Because he became really interested in a movement called the New Learning. And this had become popular because new classic Latin texts had been discovered.
Oh.
So this had happened a couple hundred years before, because people discovered a whole load of new texts by Aristotle that no one had ever read before. Wow. Which meant that people were suddenly really interested in the classics again. So it kind of happens in waves as new things come to light. So John's really interested in this. And as well as studying the classics, the New Learning movement was linked to the Protestant Reformation across Europe, which I feel like I've talked to death.
It does come up
about
a lot.
On the podcast. I'm looking forward to moving to a different time in history because somehow we're here again. But people who were interested in the New Learning movement were also interested in how the relationship between the individual and the church was changing, because ideas were evolving.
Interesting.
And as the Protestant Reformation continued, more and more people were breaking from the Catholic Church, and more people were relying on their understanding of Scripture to build their own relationship with God instead of everything coming through the Pope.
That's interesting.
Does that make sense?
That does make sense. That's interesting because a lot of, like, the current West is built on the individual and the individual's freedoms and responsibilities, which is sometimes away from the church where it's about the we.
It's interesting. It's interesting how that all kind of comes together.
And it's been, like, being formed for 500 years.
Yeah.
Weird.
John Erskine eventually came back to Scotland and he brought all of the ideas that he had absorbed and come up with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually responsible for the Greek language being taught to people in Scotland for the first time.
Wow.
Ever. He made that happen.
That's mad.
Isn't that insane?
That is insane.
Yeah.
It's insane to read the classics, you would have to learn the language that's written in.
Exactly.
That's a strange thought. very lucky to have them in, well, for us in English.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, he was responsible for that, which I just think is mega.
That is mega.
John also sympathised with the Reformation. He was a supporter of the Protestant Reformation, and he ends up being friends with a lot of the key names in the movement in Scotland.
Hmm.
He was friends with John Knox.
Oh.
Remember him?
Mm-hmm.
The very strict preacher buried in a car park. John Erskine knew him. They were each other's contemporary. They ran in the same circles. Hmm. I don't think I mentioned him in the earlier episodes because something had to get cut to keep...
Well, you had to limit it somewhere.
Well, you know, it has to end. John Erskine was also close with a man called George Wishart, who was a major figure in the Scottish Reformation.
Mm.
He was really influential, very vocal, and well-recognised. Unfortunately, Wishart was burnt at the stake as a heretic when he was only 35
Ooh.
In 1546.
That's tough.
Mm-hmm. He was burned for his beliefs because they didn't fit with how other people thought at the time. Now, we spoke to Jamie, the manager of the City of the Dead tour in Edinburgh about this a little bit, but there was a reason that when heretics were burnt at the stake, they were burned alive.
Mm-hmm.
But people who were accused of witchcraft were strangled before being burnt, which I hadn't considered when we recorded all our witchcraft episodes.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason for this was if you were burning someone as a witch and you genuinely believed that that person was a servant of the devil, then it would make complete sense that as this person was burning alive, they would curse everyone in sight and everyone that had done them harm and everyone who was responsible for this torture. But they can't do that if they're strangled first.
Yep.
They can't curse anybody. But I think that there was a reason that they were burned. It was either a symbolic gesture or...
purification. Something like that.
Yeah, yeah. But if you're a heretic, your crime is that you have different opinions to everyone else around you.
Yeah, so you show them all you want.
Yeah, you can't curse anybody. You're not a servant of the devil.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't believe what everyone else believes in. So it's perfectly acceptable for you to burn alive for your crimes.
Nasty.
Isn't it? I thought it was interesting. Now that I've laid it all out, it is quite morbid. But you know, it's okay for one and not the other.
Yeah, it is bizarre, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I also remembered there's the Erskine building at Strathclyde University.
Is there?
Yep, that's one of the buildings.
Hmm.
I bet that's... I always thought it was after the bridge. Or the place at the bridge. But it's probably after a Lord Erskine. Because all the other buildings, like the Adam Smith building, that's at Glasgow Uni, are named after famous figures. I wonder which Erskine got a university building.
You can imagine that seeing one of your friends who believes in the same things as you being burnt at the stake might make you a bit nervous.
Yeah.
But what happened to George Wishart didn't happen to John Erskine, even though it should have.
Hmm.
Because he believed in the same things. But John was very wealthy, so he wasn't punished.
Classic.
Sound familiar?
Does sound familiar.
Yeah, he was fine. One of the most interesting things about John was that he was around during the reign of Mary, Queen of Scots, and King James after her. And she's another person who features regularly on this podcast. I feel like I just talk myself into circles all the time. But even though he supported the Reformation, he actually sided with Mary of Guise while she was regent of Scotland.
Oh.
Even though she was a Catholic.
Hmm.
He supported her and helped her. Now, Mary of Guise was Mary, Queen of Scots' mother.
Mm-hmm.
And she ruled Scotland while her daughter was too young and being raised in France. Just a bit. Yep. If you didn't listen to the last episode, that's pretty much all you need to know. And John did really well supporting Mary of Guise. It was definitely the best move for him, even though it seems to go against everything he believes in.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually one of the Scottish nobles chosen to witness Mary, Queen of Scots' marriage to Prince Francis.
Wow.
Of France. He went to France and he was there.
Jeez, that's quite the honour.
Mm-hmm. And Mary of Guise had talked him up to the King of France, basically just saying how great he was, which is always nice.
That's always nice.
And he ended up being put in charge of a pretty large area around Montrose. He was the top dog. However, he got a bit upset because a French garrison was created at Montrose. Because Mary of Guise is trying to maintain order.
Mm-hmm.
She's Catholic. She's finding it difficult. And the only way she can really do it is with French support. So troops come over and help.
Yep, you're talking about that.
Yeah, they help hold the peace, basically. So the French garrison is built at Montrose, and John doesn't like it. He feels like it infringes on his power and his authority, because in a way he has to answer to the French garrison. But Mary of Guise wrote to him, assuring him he was still in power, he was still the boss, just there's French troops there now. And she did this quite often to quite a lot of people, saying one thing and doing another.
No, don't worry about it, don't worry about it.
And in the end, she, like, kind of blackmailed him. She, like, kind of threatened him in a letter. She wrote, "Otherwise, it is not best that such a thing should be done. Considering we have written so much good of your part to the king, and that now anything should be shown of you in the contrary."
Man, she was getting shit done.
Mm-hmm. So basically, you know, but we've told the French king that you're amazing, you're helping us, you're doing all this good. It'd be a shame if we had to write to him to tell him what shit you're being.
Oh, it'd be a shame if you did anything wrong, mm-hmm. to tell on you. Sure would be a shame.
Right? It definitely has that, like, flavour to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
But unlike lots of nobles that we've heard about on this podcast so far, John Erskine never really flared up in bouts of anger, or he didn't really lust after power in the same way. In fact, the thing that most people seem to notice about him was his kind nature.
Oh, that's nice.
And his quiet patience and his ability to smooth over arguments.
Mm.
He was a great mediator, which is kind of nice. It's a bit of a relief for me.
It's a nice change.
Yeah. To be able to talk about someone who's actually kind of pleasant.
Yeah, that's nice. I suppose they don't come up because it's just not as interesting.
No.
This person was super pleasant, worked diligently, had a nice family, and then died. I'm like, oh, well, that was nice.
Well, I mean, would you rather hear about that, or would you rather hear about is it Don Carlos, who's in the last episode, who was the mad Spanish prince?
Yeah.
Yeah, who would you rather listen to the story of, really? Well,
exactly. That's why the news isn't about all the nice things that happened.
Exactly. Queen Mary herself described him as a mild and sweet-natured man with true honesty and uprightness.
Oh, that's nice.
And that's big talk coming from a queen who has fundamentally different religious beliefs to you.
Yeah, at a time when that was very important.
Exactly. But more often than not, John found himself sort of in the middle of people. He was always trying to keep the peace between members of the Reformation, like John Knox, with Queen Mary, trying to keep the peace between them, or just between Protestants and Catholics generally, or even just members of the Reformation, because they fought a lot, trying to decide how they were going to move forward and what they wanted to achieve. So he was always making peace. That's what he was known for.
That's nice.
Yeah. In 1560... he was made the superintendent of the Reformed Church of Scotland for Angus and Mearns, which is the area around Dun.
Okay.
And it was a big deal because it made him an important person in the Protestant Church during a time where there was a lot of upheaval. So he was a big deal.
Mm.
He died in 1591.
I was just thinking, it's weird how the Protestants were all about getting rid of, like, the Pope and this sort of hierarchy of power, but they still have a superintendent, so there is still a hierarchy of power. It's just a different one.
It just doesn't come from the Pope.
Yeah.
He died in 1591, and he was born in 1509. So he died when he was 82.
That's good work.
In the 1500s. I'd say that's amazing. Like, I know he had a lot of money and everything, but that just didn't happen.
Yeah.
We're jumping ahead much later, in the early 1700s.
Okay.
A man called David Erskine is now the 13th Laird of Dun. And he was an incredibly important, wealthy and snooty lawyer in Edinburgh. Very posh, very well-to-do. I'm sure he was very clever. But whenever I read about people like this, I always just go, ugh.
I know. Ugh. Posh wanker.
Yeah, kind of. Well, remember I said that the current House of Dunn is a Georgian mansion?
Yes.
Well, he's responsible for that.
Oh.
He's the one who had it built. Before he built the mansion that's there now, there was what's called a tower house. It was sort of the fashion at the time mm-hmm. for the seat of a house, like a family.
Mm-hmm.
But he commissioned a great big country mansion to be built because that was how people of his calibre showed off their success. Having the house and having this property that he could hand down to his sons was a mark of his power.
Makes sense.
Basically. And the architect who designed it was a man called William Adam, who was super famous, and he's designed lots of important Scottish buildings, like fancy country houses. Mm-hmm. He helped build and design like Inverary Castle, things like that. So he got around and he helped build the House of Dunn. David Erskine was a judge and a lord and all that good stuff, but he wasn't incredibly interesting.
Mm.
I only mention him because the reason the house looks the way it does is because he had it built.
So what happened to the castle that was there?
Oh, they like got rid of it. They basically pulled it down.
Ah, fair enough.
Or
I wondered if it got ravaged in a war or something.
I don't think so.
I suppose it would have changed hands if it did that.
Yeah.
I mean, it should get old and fall apart really, wouldn't it?
Well, the archway that was part of the castle mm-hmm. is separate to the house. So they didn't build the house on top of the castle.
Hmm.
I feel like the castle was probably in a pretty bad state and then they built the mansion.
And I suppose you're saying that, well, do I want to sit in this drafty old castle after I go and visit all my friends who have these grand houses?
Yeah, because remember, they have the estate, so they have lots of land.
And the money.
Yeah. The last Erskine relative to live at Dunn was a woman called Millicent Lovett.
Hmm.
And during the Second World War, she actually had the house used as a hotel.
Oh.
Rather than living in it alone and maintaining it. She didn't even live there while it was the hotel. She moved to a smaller house on the estate rather than living in the big main house.
Like Glam's was a field hospital or something, yes. Wasn't it?
Yeah, that was World War I, oh. I think.
That's interesting. Someone else with this big house putting it to the war effort.
Well, I don't know if it was the war effort. I'm not sure. It was used as a hotel.
Maybe used as a hotel.
And this was apparently supposed to be a temporary move, just for the war and everything. But she never moved back into the house,
huh.
Ever. And when she died in 1980, she gifted the house and the estate to the National Trust.
Oh, wow.
For Scotland, which is why people can now go and visit.
Oh, and why it came up on the article I read on the National Trust website.
Yeah, that makes sense. It checks out. Yeah, she gifted it.
That's really nice.
Yeah. And she actually preserved a lot of the furniture that had been there for a long time, like furniture and antiques and things, because when she turned it into the hotel, she stashed a lot of the stuff in the attic of the house. So all of that was found again once the National Trust took over, and they had lots of the original pieces that belonged in the house.
That's awesome.
So they were able to keep them and restore them.
So I guess, is it like a visitor attraction now?
Yeah.
I wonder if you can stay there.
I don't know if you can stay there. I don't think so. It's kind of like most places, mm-hmm. most big castles. You can go round and look.
Yeah.
And you can go around the big gardens. The gardens are well kept and things as well.
Kind of like Cotter.
Yeah, yeah.
I was trying to think of what other houses. And there's the House of Brewer on the A9. That's a house off somewhere. And there's the Both House.
House of Brewer is a big gift shop, really.
Yeah, it's just a giant expensive restaurant and gift shop.
Yeah.
But presumably somebody owned it before. Yeah. Or maybe somebody.
Well, Brewer is also a place.
Grand, yeah. And then there's Both House mm-hmm. outside Aldern, or in Aldern. Which is, I think, from the picture I saw, Both House is also possibly a Georgian. Maybe.
It's
a big square one from the picture I saw.
I don't know.
Just neither here or there.
Now, I've saved the best or worst, depending on how you want to look at it.
The juiciest.
Historical Erskine story for last.
Ooh.
Because it has everything. There's murder.
Oh.
There's intrigue.
Spice.
There's witchcraft.
Ooh.
It has everything. Everything that we like.
That sounds good.
Between 1610 and 1613, two young brothers, John another John, and Alexander.
Not and Robert.
No. Were the first and second heirs to the Erskine title and fortune.
Mm.
Through a whole list of deaths and circumstances that I'm not going to get too into because it's confusing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was struggling to tell them all apart. So basically all you need to know is that they were young. John was the oldest brother and he was technically the lord of the house.
Mm-hmm.
But he was very young. And then his younger brother was second in line. Unfortunately for them, they were not surrounded by a warm, helpful, supportive family.
Oh, no.
Like you would hope to be if you were set to inherit a lot of responsibility. In 1610, their uncle, Robert, and his sisters, so the boys' aunts, Isabel, Anna, and Helen.
Not Janina, Robertina.
No. Isabel, Anna, and Helen.
Mm-hmm.
All apparently visited a woman who lived nearby called Janet Irving. Now, Janet was a witch. Air quotes. More likely, she was a cunning woman.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who knew a lot about healing. The usual story when you talk about anyone who's accused of witchcraft. I saw some of the trial documents that referred to her as a notorious witch.
Ooh.
I don't know what makes someone a notorious witch instead of just a normal witch, but apparently she was a notorious witch.
A notorious witch. Just how, I don't know, how well the writer who's writing about her writes.
I guess.
She's a witch. That's too boring. Notorious witch. Deviant witch.
Hmm.
Much more exciting. No more true.
No. Even though that's probably what she did, healing, that's not what Robert and his sisters had gone to her for.
Oh.
They had gone to Janet to buy poison from her. See, Robert felt that he would make a much better Laird of Dun than two wee boys.
Oh.
And as long as they were alive, he being much older and third in line to the estate...
He's going to poison some kids.
You know, he wasn't really in with a chance of getting what he wanted.
Yeah.
So he and his sisters decided to kill the boys.
Well, that's nice.
Isn't that nice?
That's nice.
Nice to be loved and protected and supported by your family when you need help.
Yeah, that's nice.
Now, I was a little confused at this part. Apparently, they bought the poison and gave it to the boys around 1610. But the poison took 3 years to work.
Oh.
Now, I'm not sure how they could be sure that the poison was actually responsible if anything happened after that long. Or if they had been delivering the poison consistently over 3 years.
Yeah.
I'm really not sure. I was confused at that detail.
It's good business on that cunning woman's part, though.
Well, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Take this poison and come back every week to buy some more for me and it'll work.
Well, maybe. ooh, here's a theory for you. Maybe... Mm-hmm. She knew what they were going to do with the poison.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't support the killing of children. So maybe she just gave them, wine.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
To try and save the boys.
Like flour or something.
But then, this isn't a happy story. Yeah, maybe she deliberately didn't give them something that would work.
Maybe.
However, in 1613, both of the boys were really sick. And John, the eldest brother, and technically the Laird of Dun, died.
Oh.
But miraculously, Alexander survived.
Oh.
He survived the poison, even though he had been really unwell. He managed to recover.
Damn.
But this meant that Robert and his sister's plot was discovered. Now, again, I'm not sure how. I couldn't find any details, but... You can imagine that people would have their suspicions.
Yeah.
The people who worked in the house, maybe they saw things, or people saw them talking to Janet and came to some assumptions.
What would take 3 years?
I don't know.
Unless it's you give them the poison and then they get gangrene. So then they have to lose the gangrene leg and then that gets infected and it's just it's that on and on and on and then eventually they pass away, but it was technically because of the poison. I don't know.
Well, see, in my mind, technically they are guilty because they had the motive. Like, they did try to kill them.
Oh, big time, yeah.
I don't know if they were actually responsible, if it's true that they gave them the poison in 1610 and then they died in 1613.
Well, because it could have just been, we were talking about all those plagues that were going about.
Exactly. Just illness. Well, it could just be fever. You could die from just fever.
Yeah, you could die from pretty basic things. Thank God for antibiotics.
Exactly. So, I don't know. Unless that's just an inaccuracy. Maybe they started talking to Janet in 1610 and then actually delivered the poison in 1613 and then they got sick.
Maybe.
That could be. I was a bit confused.
We could jump in our time machine.
Stop bringing it up.
And if you want to support us in our upkeep of our time machine, you can donate to the Generally Spooky Podcast. Oh,
this is the first time on the podcast that I have been interrupted mid-recording for an ad.
You just hit skip.
Anyway, confusing details. But ultimately, in 1613, John was dead and Alexander was alive. And Robert and his sisters had been found out. Now, Robert, Isabel, Anna and Helen were all arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And Janet Irving was also arrested, along with several other people who were involved in the plot. Which makes me think that someone must have been talking, because there was people from the town who were also arrested.
This is an awfully big plot.
Yeah.
Very convoluted.
Yeah.
There you go.
I think they were tried in Edinburgh. And when Robert was tried, he was actually the one who gave up his sister's role in the plot to kill the boys. He named them. And they were all charged under the witchcraft laws of the time because they had associated with a known witch.
Oh.
Janet Irving. Remember, in Scotland, you could get the death penalty just by associating with a witch. You didn't have to actually be a witch. It was very strict.
I was wondering if he was going to do the King's Evidence thing to just get away.
No. He was probably tortured and gave up the names of his sisters and the other people who were involved.
Well, maybe they weren't involved.
Well, I mean, Janet Irving wasn't a witch.
Exactly. She may have sold him some poison, but maybe he was being tortured and just had to keep saying names until they
stopped. I'm not saying that everybody actually did the thing.
No, it's interesting. Yeah. I'm not arguing with you specifically.
Feels like it. Eventually, Robert was found guilty of poisoning his nephews. I'm not sure if he was found guilty of witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
But he was found guilty of poisoning. And he was beheaded at the Mercat Cross in Edinburgh, which is right in the middle of the city.
Damn. As was befitting the nobles.
Exactly. He wasn't hung or hanged. He was beheaded because he was wealthy.
Mm.
His sisters, Isabel and Anna, were similarly charged. And in a surprising result for me, they were also beheaded.
Oh.
Now, I think it's more unusual for that to have happened to women, but I could be wrong.
Mm.
But yeah, they were also beheaded.
Well, there you go.
I couldn't find exactly what happened to Janet. I saw one place that said that she was burnt at the stake
mm-hmm.
for being the witch that concocted the poison.
A notorious witch.
Yes. But I'm not sure. I couldn't find the exact evidence. But I would believe that was the case.
Yes, that's what you would expect.
Mm-hmm. Now, the fate of Robert's youngest sister, Helen,
mm-hmm.
was different to the rest of her siblings. Mm. Only Isabel and Anna were executed, of the three sisters. Now, she was younger than the rest. I think she was only about 18.
Ooh.
She was very young. And she was actually granted clemency because she was so young and because of how remorseful she was.
Wow.
Apparently, she was heartbroken and so sorry about what she had done that she convinced them not to kill her.
Oh, wow.
Now, she wasn't allowed to return to Dun.
Mm-hmm.
She was exiled to Orkney, to the Isle of Wyre. W-Y-R-E.
Hmm.
And yeah, she stayed alive, but she had to completely start over. She was never allowed to return to mainland Scotland.
Wow.
She had to stay on that island for the rest of her life.
Oof.
And I think I saw there are currently 25 people living on the Isle of Wyre. I think there were more when she was there, but there's only 25 people living there.
Crazy.
Mm-hmm. And she settled down. She got married, she had kids, and her granddaughter was the first of her family to be given permission by the church and the community to leave the island because she was either getting married or had gotten married.
Her granddaughter.
Mm-hmm. And they basically came together and wrote a document vouching for her character and that she had a good heart and she was a good person and she was a like God-abiding person. Because she was getting married to a man who was from down south. So she had to get permission to leave.
That's insane.
Isn't it?
Oh. Imagine being born and you're trapped on this island. Which may not have been so bad at the time. Just knowing you can't leave for something you had nothing to do with.
Mm-hmm. It was something your mum did.
Yeah.
Oh. Your mum and your granny did.
Oh my days.
So you're... Because if Helen was really young when it happened, and she, I think she was called Margaret, if she was Margaret's grandmother, then they're trapped on this island for something that very few people would be alive to remember.
Yeah.
But legally, they have to stay. So that's something from a different world.
It really is.
I thought it was really interesting.
That is really interesting.
But speaking of pardons, this story isn't technically over.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
It didn't just end with all of those executions. In 2008, a man called Ewan Irvine actually brought a petition to the Scottish government calling for the pardon of the people in Perthshire who had been accused of being witches.
Oh.
Now, I think that's a pretty good idea, on the face of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these people were wrongly accused, they were tortured, they should be pardoned.
Yep.
But they didn't do anything wrong.
Better than Helen Duncan being pardoned.
Well.
Oh.
Put a pin in that. The government said no mm-hmm. in 2008. They basically explained that they couldn't deliver a pardon that was based on modern ways of thinking to charges and convictions that were brought under the laws of their time.
Mm.
So you can't look back with a different moral lens and pardon them when they were tried and charged under the laws of the land that were appropriate then.
I mean, I can see the logic there.
Does that make sense? Yep. If I explain that, okay.
They could have just gotten back in touch with him, being like, there's a global financial crisis. We're busy.
Yeah, 2008 was a bad time.
Yeah.
However, the view of the Scottish Parliament, or Scottish government, could be about to change. Because in 2018, the Historical Sexual Offences Pardons and Disregards Act was introduced. Which meant that any, I think it's just gay men, I'm not sure if...
Hmm.
If it applies to anyone else in the LGBT community, from what I could see, it was just gay men. But any gay men who were convicted of homosexual acts were granted an automatic pardon.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic.
About bloody time.
I know, right?
Jesus Christ.
I don't think it was illegal for women.
No, that's what I'm thinking, yeah. Because it said specifically it applied to gay men. And only them?
Yeah, because I think only they could be
charged.
Under that law.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so as of 2018, so only 3 years ago,
mm-hmm.
They got an automatic pardon if they had ever been charged or convicted with that crime of being gay.
How does that relate to our story?
Well, this act has nothing to do with witchcraft, obviously.
Well, yeah, it's not for gay witches.
Obviously. It could be for gay witches.
It could be for gay witches.
But it sets a precedent for convictions that were delivered on the grounds of discrimination being pardoned.
Got ya.
Which could lead to a pardon for those accused of being witches. Because a lot of the time it was discriminatory to women.
Yes. I'm with you.
From what I could see, I haven't seen any news stories on it. I'm going to have to check. But I think a new petition was brought about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
For this same thing.
Huh.
So if I find any updates, I'll look more into it. If I get any updates, I will share them here.
Yeah, share them here on the Instagram, yeah. Generally Spooky.
Yeah, because now there's a legal precedent for that to go through. So it might be different this time, I don't know.
Because it was based on ideas at the time.
Exactly. That's the crux of it.
Even if it was modern at the time, relatively.
Yeah. So there you go.
There you go.
Now, while I was researching this part of the story, there were quite a few things I took issue with. So I'm just going to say my piece and then we can move on to the spooky bits.
The next bit you're about to say, or the bit
I'm about to explain what I took issue with.
Okay.
In the comment section of the news stories about the pardon for the accused witches,
mm-hmm.
one man, of course it's a man, he talked at length about how difficult it is to imagine what it was like for these people accused of being witches, since the closest thing we have to it now is just the online trolling of women and the LBT. Which is a problem because he obviously has no idea how bad things are for people of colour,
yeah.
members of the LGBT community, or women generally, if he thinks that the worst thing that happens to these people is getting troll comments online.
Yeah, it's not really the same.
No, it's not the same. Mm. So I took issue with that, that it's not just in the past and over.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people face a lot of shit.
Yeah.
And it's important to be mindful of that. It just rubbed me up the wrong way. It really annoyed me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, you know, because the closest thing that we get to it now is just, you know, trolls on the internet. No.
No.
Do you know how many women were murdered by their partner, like, last year? So, that annoyed me. I just had to say it.
Yep.
Secondly, I do not agree with everything that you and Irvin is trying to do and believes in.
Okay.
In an interview, he talks about Helen Duncan. I knew you were going to react like that. We talked about Helen Duncan in our witchcraft miniseries.
Yeah.
So, if you want to know what I'm talking about, just listen to the episode. But he calls her the Joan of Arc of the spiritualist movement.
Oh, it's just so incorrect.
And how she died due to psychic injuries that she sustained during her arrest. He and his partner claim that the energy she used to build up a materialization of spirit rushed back into her body and damaged her. And they also say there was never any evidence of Helen being a fraud. Except that there was.
Except all the evidence.
Yes. Now,
apart from all the evidence, there's no evidence at all.
Yeah. So, if you want to have that opinion on Helen Duncan, fine, in my opinion.
Yeah.
My issue with everything that he said in the article that I read and everything he's pushing for is that he's trying to secure a pardon for Helen Duncan in the same way that he's trying to secure a pardon for those accused of being witches hundreds of years ago.
They're just not the same.
No, and he's put them in the same group, and I don't think that's fair because it completely weakens and cripples the argument for pardons for these people who were tortured and treated brutally.
Well, there's being tortured, strangled, and then burned to death.
Yes.
And then there's going to jail for 6 months.
9 months. 9 months. 9 months. But that's what I have an issue with. If you believe that Helen Duncan was genuine, you know, believe what you want to believe. You're not hurting anybody. Fine. Don't put her in the same group as people accused in the witch trials.
Yeah.
It's not the same.
It's not the same.
And it cheapens their experience. Uh-huh. And it makes their experience, I don't know. It really, really bothers me. So I just wanted to say that I don't agree with uh-huh. that. And I don't think it's right. Like, they're Helen Duncan and people accused in the witch trials, their supposed crimes and the punishment for those crimes are not the same.
No.
At all. And shouldn't be treated as the same. And that's what I wanted to say. Wind me up.
Mm. I can see why.
And if you're listening to this back when you edit and I'm too angry, you can get rid of it. But I had to say it.
So, spookiness?
Yes, we can get into the spooky now.
Spooky. Spooky dokey then.
There are many spooks at the House of Dun. House of Dun, yes. Many spooks. If you go to visit the House of Dun,
mm-hmm.
there are big gardens surrounding the house, like I said.
Spooky gardens.
And in one part, you'll find a sculpture of a sword in a tree stump.
Ooh.
Which in itself is very, very cool.
Yeah, I know, that's good.
I want one. But there's a legend behind the sculpture in the garden,
mm-hmm.
which has its own ghost story attached.
Mm-hmm.
Now, during the Crusades, a knight from the area around Dun went off to fight. And the Crusades happened often between like the 1000s and the 1500s.
Yep.
He left his wife behind when he went off to fight, as was common.
Yep, couldn't fit her in your pocket.
Nope, not everyone's as short as me. And unfortunately, another knight who lived in the area knew that he had left and moved in on his wife. He told her that her husband had died.
Oh, cheeky bastard.
And she was heartbroken. But she agreed to marry the second knight when he explained that it was her husband's last wish that she do so. As if.
Cheeky bastard.
If you went off to war, I do not believe that you would leave notes being like, yeah, this is who you're going to marry when I die.
Yeah. Saying to your pal, go back to my wife, tell her I love her, and tell her I want you to marry her in my stead.
Yeah. Very strange. Years passed, and then, miraculously, the first knight came home from war alive. But he returned and found that his wife had remarried. He was horrified, but not more horrified than she was when she discovered she'd been lied to.
Yeah.
A fight broke out in the trees near the House of Dun between the two knights. But just as it looked like her first husband, her true husband, was going to die, The woman grabbed his sword and ran the liar straight through, impaling him on a tree.
Oh.
For what he had done.
Good work.
That's a badass story, isn't it?
That is a badass story.
Well, in more recent times, several people have seen a knight around the place where the fight happened.
Interesting.
They see a knight walking around. Some of them have seen him. But other people have seen a knight headless on a horse.
Oh.
Riding around the House of Dun.
Interesting. Headless horseman.
Mm-hmm. In an article from the Montrose Review in 1850, a journalist wrote about how locals from like Brechin and places around avoided the House of Dun at night completely because so many of them had seen or run into the headless horseman.
Wow.
They avoided it. They didn't want anything to do with it because it wasn't just a legend. It was an understanding that he was there.
Yeah.
And you didn't want to run into him.
That's pretty good.
Can you imagine how terrifying it would be to just be by yourself on a road in the dark at night and just hearing the hoofs and just the thunder and then just seeing someone without a head?
Yeah. I think you could fact check some of them and be like, oh, what did he say to you? Oh, God, he said this to me. Like, oh, he didn't have a head.
God, you're such a physicist. I read a lot of people talking about the Headless Horseman as the knight from the Crusades, from the story.
Mm-hmm.
But I have an alternative theory, which I thought was interesting. And this is coming from someone who's never visited the House of Dun, has never seen the knight for myself. Just, that's the disclaimer. I'm aware of this. It's just a theory. I thought it when I was putting everything together. What if this headless phantom isn't the knight? What if the headless ghost is Robert Erskine?
Oh.
Who was beheaded for killing his nephew.
I mean, he was beheaded.
He would have reason to stay at the House of Dun forever.
Yep, this knight wasn't beheaded. Well, he might have been beheaded after, but he was ran through.
What if?
What if?
Don't think it's completely unreasonable. Yeah.
Again, you can't ask him.
No.
Or he can't answer.
Well, I mean, in quite a lot of the stories and photos and things, they're like holding their head.
That's true. Maybe you can just,
like, they carry their head with them.
Like, they're a ghost. They might be able to talk out ahead with the windpipe.
Maybe.
There's no air going in and out anyway.
I mean, they're a ghost. They've already broken through the reality barrier. Everything else is just fun.
You just like clap once for yes and twice for no.
Sign language.
Oh, yep.
Anyway, that's one of the legends. What's interesting, when I was doing my research into headless horseman ghosts, which is a strange thing to say, is that legends of headless horsemen are actually a big part of Scottish folklore.
Really?
Yeah, it happens over and over again. Mm. And it's the same in Irish folklore too. In Irish legends, there's a demonic headless horseman who carries his own head, like I said, and he holds it by his leg. But he carries a whip with him that's made out of a human spine.
Oh, that's good work.
Like, the vertebrae.
Yeah.
Oh. But yeah, it's a recurring legend.
There he is, riding along, see someone, whoopa, gets him with his whip.
This is my fault. I made you a caffeinated beverage.
That's what this is.
This is my fault. I've only myself to blame. Now, other people have reported both hearing and seeing a harpist who was killed in the gardens of the house.
Hmm.
Which I don't think I've ever heard before.
No.
A phantom harpist.
No, definitely not. That's new to me.
I see, in my head, something unusual like that. I'm like, well, why would you make that up? Who would think of that? You'd think of like a bloody soldier or, you know,
the knight who was wronged by his...
but a harpist?
Wife. Fellow knight. A harpist.
Mm-hmm.
Just sitting there, twangling away.
Yeah. But how scary would that be? Just hearing a harp.
Yeah.
With nobody playing in the dark. That'd be creepy, because it's so, like, plinky plonky.
I know. That'd be very spooky.
But that gave me, like, a wee shiver when I read it, because I just thought that was such a strange encounter.
Uh-huh.
I've never heard of that before.
That is unusual. I mean, it's so heavenly, traditionally.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't even think of that.
Music from a harp.
Yeah.
Or it's like a little harp. The angels play.
So there you go.
There you go.
There's lots of other strange noises that visitors to the house and the staff who work there have reported. The most common ones are a phone ringing.
Oh, yeah.
Like a landline phone.
Uh-huh.
But in a part of the house where there is no phone.
Oh, that's pretty weird.
Now, that's a strange one as well, because it's not something that would pop into your head if you were going to make up like a ghost story. Oh, I hear footsteps.
Yeah.
But a phone ringing.
That is more unusual.
And that's a modern convenience.
Yeah.
But yeah, they hear a phone ringing, a landline phone, in a part of the house where there's no phone connected. A creepier one is a lot of people have heard a baby crying. When there are no children, no babies that you should be able to hear. Now, that would be the end for me. I'd be in bits. not even just because I was afraid. I'd be heartbroken if I was just having to listen to a phantom baby crying.
That would be really sad, wouldn't it?
I would hate it.
And you'd be there freaking out and crying. I'd be like, I can't hear anything. What are you talking about?
Yeah, pretty much. That would make it worse.
Historically.
Yeah. So the House of Dunn really seems like the kind of haunted house that you have in your head when you're told to imagine a haunted house. People have seen and heard phantom dogs running around the grounds in the house. There was one story a woman told who, I think they were staying in like a house on the grounds, not the main house. And she had her children with her. And she was talking about how her children had seen this dress moving around by itself as if someone was walking, but there was no body in the dress.
Ew.
It was just walking around.
Weird.
Which, like, I've got goosebumps just thinking about how creepy that would be.
Yeah. Ooh, God, can you imagine?
Oh, can you imagine turning around, like, to look in a doorway and just seeing a dress standing there?
Yeah.
A little bit off the ground.
That would be bizarre. In Greyfriars, I looked over at one point. I was just weird, shimmering mist going down the path. And I was like, oh, that's a bit weird. I looked away. I looked back in, it was still there. And it moved on a little bit. And I looked over and there was a guy smoking, hiding behind, like, the other side of a mausoleum. Like, ah, you bastard, you totally got me.
That's the problem with vaping.
Yeah, it was
those
like
big billowy clouds. Because you can recognise cigarette smoke, I feel.
Yeah, it was just big, you know, the way it was
moving.
You know
it when you see it.
In the street lamp light was really weird.
But vape smoke is a whole new phenomenon.
Yeah. So that kind of oogled me out. So to look over and just see a full-on dress walking past with nobody in it, it's a bit much.
Mm-hmm. Creepy.
Yeah. Nope. I'd leave.
One of the, like, major ghostly residents of the house is known as the Lady of Dunn. And she's seen a lot. So the story of the dress is sometimes attributed to being her. But she's sometimes seen riding backwards on a phantom horse.
Oh, that would be weird.
Which would be horrifying.
God, because in my head she's screaming as well.
Oh, sitting backwards.
Yeah. Oh, God, I just looked out the window and saw the neighbour next door and just crapped myself. Because I head just bobbed past the fence. So...
Okay, you're overdue for a good fright. I got it down at Greyfriars. You're overdue.
Head still on body, we're fine.
Yeah, just our neighbour. Our neighbours are nice. Nothing to fear. Well, as well as riding backwards on a phantom horse, she's seen lots and lots and lots. She's seen wandering around the grounds. She's seen in rooms of the house. Just, and nobody can explain it. Lots of people have seen her. In 1848, just a while ago, the legend of the Lady of Dunn was included in a book called The Night Side of Nature by a woman called Catherine Crow. Now, you can buy this book. I'm going to try and get a copy, but I think it's quite rare and quite expensive.
Is that Night with a K or an N?
N. So the night side of nature. And in this book, Catherine Crow wrote, "Not very long since, a gentleman set out one fine midsummer's evening, when it is light all night in Scotland, to walk from Montrose to Brechin. As he approached a place called Dunn, he observed a lady walking on before, which, from the lateness of the hour, somewhat surprised him. Sometime afterwards, he was found by the early labourers lying on the ground, near the churchyard, in a state of insensibility. All that he could tell them was that he had followed this lady, till she had turned her head and looked round at him. When seized with horror, he had fainted."
Oh,
said they, "you've seen the Lady of Dunn." What the legend attached to this Lady of Dunn is, I do not know.
Ooh. Go on, get me chilled.
Spooky.
Spooky.
Does she turn to look at him and he just... he collapsed.
Freaked the fuck out.
Yeah. And like Catherine wrote, no one is really sure who she is.
Yeah.
Maybe it's one of the executed sisters.
Maybe.
It could be someone from a long time before that. We don't know.
Maybe. Ooh.
Yeah. Now, the House of Dunn actually got quite famous after people read this in Crow's book. It was 1848, so it was the Victorian era, and people were really into ghost stories. So people read this, and it really put the House of Dunn on the map. People wanted to go, people wanted to see for themselves, that kind of stuff. However, a woman called Violet Jacob, who, she was a member of the Erskine family, she wrote a book of her own, basically saying that every single ghost story that comes out of the house is nonsense. It's called The Lairds of Dunn, and it's all about her family's history, and it came out in 1931. So about 100 years later? Yeah. Almost 100 years later. And do you want to hear what she wrote?
Yes.
She said, "There is no well-authenticated ghost to trouble Dunn, neither monk nor white lady to scare the loiterer in the den, nor uncomfortable shadowy inmate of the house. Vague traditions exist of a limb falling from one of the spreading yew trees of the kitchen garden at the death of a laird, and, in the event of twins being born in the family, the arrival of one of them in the world with a black leg. But, though the generation that is thinning every day has seen the death of two lairds and the birth of twin sons in the direct line, these tales have been proved by the event to be futile. And only the Scottish poet George Beattie has thought fit to invent a spectre for the place in his ballad of the Murderate Minstrel," who's the harpist. Now, I can totally understand why you would write that if you suddenly had lots of people speculating about your family, your home.
Yeah.
Your history.
And just be, what's the word, harassed.
Yeah, like, if you wanted people to leave it, then coming out with a book of the facts is the way to go.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
And it's always so much easier to disprove than prove.
Yeah.
One of the hard things about it.
But it was interesting that one of the legends is, like, a limb falling from a tree meant that the laird was about to die.
Oh, that's unusual.
Yeah, I'd never heard that before. No. In the more present day, though, staff working at the house claim to have seen a woman walking around, sometimes in servants' clothes, sometimes just wandering around the servants' quarters. And in 2005, a psychic visited the house, and she claimed that the place was full of spirits. She sensed ghostly dogs, she sensed a young girl, and what she described as an imposing gentleman, evidently to the manner born.
Could it be old Bobby?
Which could build on my headless horseman theory.
Yep.
If he's still cracking about.
Hmm.
I'd really love to go wander around.
I know, that'd be a good one.
I'm feeling more brave now that we're not in Greyfriars Kirkyard anymore. But I really think it would be interesting to walk around and just see.
Yeah, big time.
So what do you think?
Ooh, very spooky. I'm still laughing that the psychic found all these spirits. Well, that's good for business, isn't it?
That's Kieran, the ham sandwich.
I'm the psychic who never detects anything. Like, that's not going to get you. That's not going to get you booked, is it?
You're charming.
I know.
That's the only thing you're going to take from my tale.
End of statement. Thank you for your questions.
Well, that is the story of the House of Dun.
Wow. That was a good one.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Are you pleased since you requested it?
I am, yeah. Plenty of spooking.
I love a good spooky story. Mm-hmm. I love a good haunted house story.
I like that. Mm.
And we have at least three more this season.
Ooh, stay tuned.
That I have lined up over Halloween. Because that's when you want to hear about a haunted house. It's over Halloween.
It's the time for the spook.
But yeah, what did you think of the story? Do you have any thoughts?
The one on the night is interesting. I wonder if there'd be any way to, like, verify that.
I don't know.
Were there. Don't really know. Depends who it is and stuff. I wonder who built the statue as well.
Yeah, I don't know who the sculptor was.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's someone that the family commissioned, maybe.
Or when the sculpture was made.
You see, because I'd like to go and I'd like to see it.
Well, because that seems like where you'd find it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very interesting. They don't seem as terrible as some of the Glam's lords were.
Well, I mean, it's a spectrum, isn't it?
Yeah.
But you can't forgive one person's bad things because they aren't as bad as someone else.
No, definitely not. That's a slippery slope, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ooh. I enjoyed all the spookiness. Not least because it got dark while we were talking. It's very dark in here now.
It's September now. It doesn't stay light all the time anymore while we record.
We don't have those midsummer eves of Scotland to see ghost ladies wandering around. The Lady of Dun.
Definitely creepier to see a ghost in the daytime.
Yeah, big time.
For me, that would be way creepier.
What if, like, you've seen ghosts before and they were just so realistic you just thought it was a person and never even conceived it was a ghost? So a ghost came out to you and like, oh, excuse me, like, which way is London? And you're like, that's a bit weird, is it that way? And then they're like, oh, thanks, and wander off. So you're like, man, that was a weirdo, and that was actually a ghost.
Well, I've heard people's stories where they've talked about being around a ghost that was so real that they had conversations and felt them move, and then they turn around and they're completely gone.
Weird.
I have read those before, and I've heard those stories before. Yeah.
Fully corporeal,
yeah.
I suppose. Strange thought.
I mean, I believe it could happen. I know you don't believe it could happen.
I don't really believe it could happen.
I believe it could happen.
Me and my ham sandwich.
No, you are the ham sandwich.
Me.
Thank you very much for listening to our spooky story.
Thank you so much. And if you are enjoying the podcast, please consider donating to us.
Yeah, we have a donate button.
Yep. On jiminyspooky.com/donate. It would be immensely helpful and we'd be infinitely appreciative.
But you know what? In failing that, there are free ways you can support the podcast.
Yes, there are.
You can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts.
Yep.
Because that really helps other people find us who might enjoy it.
Yep.
You can follow us on social media.
Yep. Instagram is probably the best place, but we're now also on Twitter.
Yep. And we have a Facebook page if you're interested. It's all there.
But Facebook doesn't let us show it to anybody.
Nope.
Without paying them, which we're not going to do.
You can email requests and reviews to our email address.
Yep.
generallyspooky@gmail.com.
Yep. Get in touch if you have something to say.
Yeah.
And that's that.
And we will speak to you next week.
Yes. Yes, we will. We will see you for episode four.
Episode four.
Bye.
Bye.